Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Loren Cohen-Tanuji, who is a French intellectual and author and an international lawyer. His new book is The Shape of the World to Come, Charting the Geopolitics of a New Century. Loren, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Tunisia, in the Mediterranean, and spent my childhood there, and which was actually a very, very nice country, a very sort of cosmopolitan and open country, a little bit like the way you might think of Lebanon in the good old days. Then moved to France when I was a teenager, and I've been based in Paris ever since, but also lived in America for a couple of years and studied here.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Oh, they certainly gave me a great education, for one thing. And I remember stories about the war and Tunisia. Obviously, Tunisia was less affected than Eastern Europe.
This would be World War II?
Yeah. But I remember the stories of the Germans in Tunisia and my father being a prisoner and escaping, and also the value of the American partnership. All those things have shaped me. America has always been like, together with France, from Tunisia, France was the sort of the cultural reference, and America was the security, the protection, also the admiration of the success. And so those two poles, I think, have shaped me since my childhood.
And was there a discussion beyond what you just said of politics, of world politics around the dinner table?
No, not at all. In fact, we were not. My parents were separated when I was a child, so there was no real. I really developed that interest personally, and always was all interested in public affairs, and I hesitated for a long time between. Actually, I have sort of a pretty diverse background. I'm supposed to be a professor of literature. I also did political science and then ended up becoming a corporate lawyer. But I always wrote in parallel and on public affairs and international affairs.
And how did you pursue that through your education? I mean, did you do journalism, or was it just writing essays as part of the public discourse or the life?
I do write columns from time to time, but I've never actually worked as a journalist. I've always been a lawyer for my profession, and I wrote essays on the side. But it has become a second career, because one thing led to another, and I'm spending more and more time lecturing around the world and also writing. And I've had several key subject. Actually, my first book I wrote right after coming back from the United States, when I spent 2 years. And the first book was about the comparison of the role of law and lawyers in American democracy and in French democracy. I was trying to explain why is law so important in the United States, and why was it, because that's changed, so unimportant in France and in European culture. Mm-hmm. And that's how I started.
But let's go back to your education a minute. So you were educated in France, and then you said in the United States. Tell us a little about that. What you majored in literature? Is that what you just said?
Or? We don't have exactly the same system, but I went to the École Normale Supérieure, which is one of the French grandes écoles, elite schools, and I majored in literature. But I didn't. I knew I didn't want to be a professor or a teacher, and so I also did political science studies and was interested in going to government school. But then I felt also I had an international fiber, and I didn't feel like I wanted to be too constrained in the French administration. And so I decided to go for a more international career and for a more sort of private sector oriented, and I think that I wouldn't have been able to write these books if I hadn't done that. So I'm a kind of atypical animal.
You said you studied here in the United States?
Yeah.
And what sort of studies were those? Legal studies?
Yeah, or? I did a master's degree at Harvard Law School. But that was sort of at the end of my study. I'd already done law and political science in France, and so I did a sort of a graduate program here. And then I worked in New York City.
So what is? Are there common themes that run through? You said you've written 8 books or so. What sort of problems have interested you?
Well, as I said, I started with this. Really, was a personal inquiry because I really discovered the world of law and lawyers in America. It was something that I had no idea about, and so I started from there. And so it was really about law and democracy. And then from that, I wrote 2 books on these topics. And then from that, I got interested in European unification because Europe is primarily a legal system that has a lot of similarity with the U.S. Federal system. And then I got engaged in that book came out at the time of the Maastricht referendum. So I got engaged in the campaign and I became a sort of European militant and for Europe and for sort of political Europe, and so then I still spend a lot of time on European policy making, and I met Jacques Delors and I joined his think tank and so the last phase from that I moved to transatlantic relation because I would define myself as a Euro-Atlanticist. In other words, I don't see any conflict between being for favor of a strong Europe and also a Europe that is a close partner to the United States. And so I wrote this book about transatlantic relations of the Atlantic Alliance after September 11, and then this last book about globalization.
And we'll talk about that in a minute. I'm curious, what on this intellectual journey, beginning with this comparison of American lawyers and French lawyers, what was the conclusion, and how has it informed your kind of understanding of the subtleties of the relationship?
About the first book, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, the first book was really the thesis was that it was in the mid-80s, and France and other parts of Europe wanted to reduce the role of the states in their economies and societies. And I guess my message was, if you want to reduce the role of the states, you have to replace it by something else. And that something else is the rule of law. Mm-hmm. And the French really didn't have that in mind. They thought about the market, but they didn't really see that the market also needed to, law and market go together. And that was really the big contribution that made the book famous. And still today, a lot of people tell me that this book is the one that, you know, contributed to most to their thinking. So that's the way it started.
Self-identify as a public intellectual, and that is a term that we used to have here when we had people like Galbraith and Schlesinger and so on, but it's less clear that we still have that. So I would be curious, because you're really moving between realms. You're an international lawyer who does corporate work, but at the same time you're talking about public issues and making important arguments about, for example, Europe.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the figure of public intellectual is, I think, is a typically French figure, you know, long tradition, you know, of Sartre, Aron, and so on and so forth. Even those figures are, even in France, those figures are disappearing. I think what's specific to me is that I'm, as you said, I'm also in the real world, quote unquote. I mean, I'm in business, but at the same time, I try to reflect on public policy issues, and that is a combination that even in France is not very common, because lawyers tend to be more and more specialized, and they don't really have the time or the interest of going outside their sphere. But I always had this tension. I try to basically continue in my professional career the kind of mix that I had during my studies, where I always did like 3 things at the same time. I enjoy that.
As in the ideal type of a public intellectual, does that mean somebody who's writing about issues of concern to public policy, but and also public education, or are the two separate? I'm curious about that because that's a, there's a void here, I believe, in our country for this vocation.
I think maybe what distinguishes it is that it's you're trying to influence public debate. So it's not only an academic endeavor. You're trying to be a voice. So that requires being somewhere in the media, either writing or being on. So to have a say in the public debate. So it's not like strictly academic. It's really to want to influence
the debate.
Yeah.
So your new book is The Shape of the World to Come. Let me show it again to our audience. What was your purpose in writing it?
Well, I wrote it because I was really shocked by September 11 when it happened, and I felt immediately that this was a turning point. I thought that the world really had changed, and the Europeans didn't feel like that. It took them a while to actually measure, first of all, the impact that it had on the United States, but also to also measure the impact it had on. It took maybe 2 years, and I think that part of that disconnect probably explained the misunderstandings about Iraq and all the crises that we've had 2 or 3 years later. But to me, it was very, very sort of intuitive feeling. And so the book was really to try to explain in what way we were entering into a different world, not only because of September 11, but there are a number of other elements, but that the post-Cold War era that had started with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, that parenthesis was over. And I was trying to describe the new world that we are entering into and make sure the public opinion and political leaders were fully aware of it.
Before we go into describing the world and this strange encounter between globalization and geopolitics, I want to ask you, because what we had in this country in the 1990s was a debate dominated by Francis Fukuyama's book, in which the idea was that history was over. I'm simplifying now, and his book was more complicated, right, but that was the way that it was interpreted by the public discourse.
Right.
And that was because the wall had fallen, democracy was triumph along with the market economy.
Right.
Did that view of the world distort our understanding of globalization and the dynamic that emerges and which you describe in your book?
Yeah, I guess some of the forces that I described in the book were obviously already at work. But it's true that we were, during that decade, overwhelmed by the end of the Cold War, which was obviously a very positive thing, that seemed to be, in fact, a spread of democracy in the market around the world. There were hope that Russia was going to evolve into a modern democracy and market economy. There was the Oslo peace process in the Middle East. There was the Internet revolution. A lot of positive things that made us think that, you know, we were really entering into a happy phase. But of course, during that time, a number of forces were already at work that sort of exploded at the beginning of the years 2000.
And one of the assumptions of the debate here in the United States, and some might say that this was a kind of an ideology that the state embraced here in the United States to rationalize the enormous power that America seemed to have in the world with the fall of communism, the notion that geopolitics was over,
and that
globalization was putting the nail in the coffin. Talk a little about that, because that's really a central point that you're making.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, even before the collapse of the Soviet Union, ever since the détente, really, in the 80s and the 90s were really the two decades where, that was already at work in the 80s, in other words, that we thought that economics were totally disconnected from politics, that there was actually a disappearance of geopolitics, that we were really in a sort of purely, a world of market economies and democracies and the rule of law and human rights. It was really a happy moment. And it was also the time of what we call in Europe the unipolar moment of American supremacy after the fall of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so what we are witnessing today is a comeback of geopolitics, of power strategies, and the end of this illusion that economics can be sort of disconnected from politics. And the title of the book, for instance, is really a sort of reference to Tom Friedman's Flat World. And mm-hmm. basically what I'm saying is that the world is not flat. And we can see that it is much more complicated than that. But the flat world theory is basically another expression of the end of history, of the liberal dream of that, which is a reality to a large extent, that commerce brings or promotes peace and harmony among nations. It's an old idea that since the 18th century or longer has been the dominant idea, and again for good reasons. But what we are witnessing today, that globalization does not only bring peace and harmony, but it also brings conflict and fragmentation. Mm-hmm. And that's really a change of paradigm from the 80s and the 90s.
So there's a duality here, a tension yep. between the elements that are integrating the world and making us homogeneous, right. but on the other hand, a kind of a resistance to that.
There's a resistance, and for the example of that is, for instance, the rise of Islamism, for instance, which you could interpret to some extent. I'm not saying it's the whole story, but as a resistance to the sort of cultural and economic domination of Western civilization and of American. I mean, globalization for a long time has been associated with America. It was, even in Europe, we call it American globalization or Anglo-Saxon globalization. But there's another phenomenon, that globalization is the source of an even more important historical shift, which is the rise of new emerging powers in the East, mm-hmm. in Asia, China, India, and others. And that is the product of globalization, because mm-hmm. it's by opening their borders, as a result of trade liberalization, that those giants have finally taken off, mm-hmm. and that is creating causing a return of geopolitics through, for instance, the energy question, because the huge demands of China and India for energy to fuel their growth is creating competition among the consuming countries in Central Asia and Africa, and it's bringing back the sort of grand game of the 19th century for the competition for energy resources.
So let's break these apart, right. because you're in your book you're identifying and you've touched on two of the destabilizing forces. But let's go to the first one you mentioned, and that is the emergence of Islam as a destabilizing factor in world politics. And talk a little about that, because what you are showing is that it's not just this confrontation with the West, but the divisions within Islam itself, between Shia and Sunni, between Sunni governments and Sunni radicals. And so play that out a little, and to what extent is globalization a factor that has enhanced that destabilization?
Well, as you just said, we see Islamism. I'm not talking about Islam, obviously, but Islamism, and the terrorism factor has been sort of overwhelming and occupying center stage for good reasons. But there are numerous other manifestations. First, the rise of Islamist parties in much of the Arab Muslim world through sort of democratic means, elections. There is obviously the rise and the threat of Iran, which has been strongly reinforced by the situation in Iraq, the weakening of Iraq. There's numerous cultural and religious confrontations between Islam and Western civilization, in Europe in particular, where there's a significant Muslim population. So all these phenomena are part of the same thing. And right now, the situation in the Middle East is not only about the Israeli Palestinian conflict, but there are a lot of other conflicts that are, in my view, even more significant for regional and global stability. And obviously, Iran is on top of the list, but it's also frightening to not only to Israel but also to a lot of Gulf states and Sunni countries. So
and importantly, you're emphasizing that the combination of the radical Islamists' capacity to see all these conflicts as coming under one umbrella on the one hand, in response to the American invasion of Iraq. So there is a vicious dynamic here, right, that certainly burst on the scene, where conflicts that may be separable, right, have been, by the extremists, made to appear as if they're one.
Yeah, the extremists have what we might call a globalization strategy. In other words, they are making links, and they are putting everything in stage as a global conflict between Islam and the West. And of course, we must not fall into this trap, but that's their strategy, and we certainly should not encourage that strategy. And some mistakes have been made in that sense. And so. So that's clearly one element of not only destabilization, but there's a risk of a new sort of East-West conflict, and it's probably the last ideological conflict, because there's no more ideology in Russia, for instance. Mm-hmm. But we certainly don't want this religious ideological conflict of new sort to take over. I mean, we need to avoid that.
Now the second destabilizing feature, which you mentioned, was the rise of these newly industrialized countries, especially Brazil, Russia, China, and India. I believe they're called the BRICS.
Right.
And the point that you're making, which is an important one, is that the mystique of globalization failed to attune us to the extent to which globalization would change the hierarchy in political economic terms.
Right. And I would, even though the BRIC countries are usually talked about together, I would really distinguish. I mean, China and India are a different category than Brazil and Russia. But China is the only country that, I mean, it's already today the third economy in the world, and is supposed to, or expected to, become the second, and to be at par with the United States, within just a few decades. Already, it is the second country in terms of R&D spending, for instance, ahead of Japan. It has a third military budget in the world. It's a huge emerging power, and it also, as I was saying a moment ago, it has a very aggressive strategy of trying to find energy resources. It has a sort of strategy in Africa, for instance. It's extremely present, investing in Africa and in Central Asia, and so it is not only an economic phenomenon, but it is clearly a geopolitical phenomenon. And in economic terms, it has huge consequences because of just the mass effect on the rise of prices, of energy prices, of raw material prices. All that is, to to a large extent the result of the new huge demand of China, India, and other countries. So it is a tremendous, it's also a historic return in a way, because before the Industrial Revolution in the West, China and India accounted for about 30% of world GDP in the beginning of the 19th century, and then of course it went down. So it's a return of this empire, the forefront of history.
You make the point that especially these Russia, Brazil, India, and China are all continental powers,
right,
which means a large market.
Right.
And as you just said, they're nations with illustrious histories.
Right.
And they have leaders who want to return and can return to the international stage.
Right. If you, they are continental-sized powers. They are a strong nation with a great history, and you can see a return of nationalism. Obviously, in Russia, for instance, it's obvious. But even China has a very nationalistic and sovereignist tradition, and you can see how Vladimir Putin, for instance, is using the energy weapon to really reestablish Russia as a regional, if not global, power. And so that is, and China also has legitimate ambitions to become not only an economic superpower, but also a geopolitical power. And so that's the world that we are entering into. The expression for that is a multipolar world. And for there were probably some illusions in France, in particular, that the multipolar world would be a more balanced, harmonious world that would be a counterweight to the American hyperpower and so on and so forth. But what we're seeing is that this multipolar world is, in fact, much more unstable and predictable and to some extent dangerous than both the unipolar world of the 90s, but even perhaps a bipolar world of the Cold War. And so we have to now deal with this new new geopolitical environment.
You make an important point in your book. You're comparing the situation of the West, Europe and the U.S., versus these new powers, these emerging powers. And you say emerging powers have benefited from globalization and can mobilize the masses around it because globalization is associated with prosperity, recovered national pride, and more liberties. So what you're suggesting is that these global processes are situating these states to be in a more advantageous position than the West.
Sure. I mean, globalization is obviously, I think it's a good thing for everybody, including the West, but for China and India, it means, you know, hundreds of millions of people coming out of poverty and you know, making this becoming a middle class, and obviously there's still more freedom than there used to be. It's opening up, so it's a tremendously positive thing. It's huge surpluses. China has, I think now, $2 trillion of exchange reserves. It's a tremendous boost, and it's true that globalization is a different feeling than it has in the West, where it's seen more as a threat. It's certainly the case in France, for instance, but it's starting to be the case in the United States. So globalization has become, from us being a sort of an American-led phenomenon, is now more synonymous with the rise of Asia and the threat to European and American jobs, which it is to some extent, but globally, it is still a very positive force, including for the West.
Before we talk about what's happening in the West, I'm curious, because you're somebody who's worked in America and in Europe, and you've thought about these issues. What accounts for the myopia did not help us anticipate these developments? I mean, because it's very important to say, well, globalization is going to change the world, but not kind of realize in the U.S. the implications of this. I mean, theoretically, what was wrong with our ideas that we didn't anticipate the kinds of things that you're describing? Is it that you wrote later? What is the difference?
No. I think, again, in the 90s, we were sort of totally self-centered in a way, because it was really the triumph of Western ideas. We were all into the new economy that was supposed to last forever. We were into spreading democracy around the world. We were into internet and all those things. And then after that, when things started changing, I think terrorism became the center of attention. Again, for right reason, but we didn't see that there's probably historically a more important phenomenon, which is, again, this shift of wealth, of power. Of course, the energy prices have also played a role, and we've witnessed this huge transfer of wealth to oil and gas producing countries and to countries with trade surpluses like China, and that's really put us in a different game. All the more so because the West itself has had its own setbacks. We are witnessing a weakening of the West, not only as a mechanical consequence of the rise of the East, but also for intrinsic reasons. And so I think that the another real signpost of this shift to a new world is the fact that the West is losing its monopoly. That's really the term that the West had a monopoly on world affairs for not only since the end of World War II, but maybe since the end of the Industrial Revolution. Since the Industrial Revolution, the West, America, and Europe basically led the way in everything, in economic terms, and military, cultural, information, science and technology, and so we are beginning to see this monopoly eroded, and more we will face competition, and we certainly are sort of a minority in demographic terms. World population is supposed to increase by, I think, 45% by 2050, and the West will have only a very tiny fraction of that increase. And also economically, we will represent less and less of world GDP. And for the first time, you're going to have a coincidence of growth and economic wealth and population, and that's in Asia.
Mm-hmm. You identify two points in time that are kind of symbolic turning points for the decline of the West, or the extent to which these were really setbacks. One is the Iraq invasion for the United States and the failure of that effort. But then also you see in the failure of the two European countries to ratify the Constitution as a turning point for the European. Talk about especially the second one, because you are somebody who takes a more critical view of the European experiment. What happened to it, and why did it go off track?
Sure. The first, maybe I'll just start by saying that there's a paradox that the end of the Cold War, which was supposed to represent the triumph of the West, actually has started to make it more difficult for the West, for the transatlantic relationship. First of all, because the common enemy that federated the alliance disappeared. And so there was a sense of, you know, what is this alliance still relevant? And so it started to have more problem in the 90s between Europe and America than before. But coming to your question, I'm not critical of the European enterprise. I'm just critical of the way it has been. I think that the key issue in European unification is that we have enlarged more and more. We have taken on more and more countries without securing a true agreement on the project, on, you know, what is the ultimate goal, where do we want to go. And so now it is becoming very difficult at 27 countries where you need unanimity to adopt any new treaty, and where each country can, you know, do a national referendum. And so everything is held hostage to essentially domestic politics, mm-hmm. like we're seeing now with the Irish no vote, which is holding up everything. So that's the problem in Europe. And I was saying that symbolically, and pretty much at the same time, the U.S. got stuck mm-hmm. in Iraq, and the Europeans were unable to make the step towards further political unification. And those two events at the same time are highly symbolic of the difficulties of the West. There are other phenomena. Take multilateralism. Multilateralism was an invention of the West and a positive invention after World War II, the Bretton Woods Institution, all the international organization. And we're seeing that those institutions don't work anymore because of, first of all, the rule of unanimity sometimes, because of the UN traditional issues. And because...
And who are the members with what voting powers?
Yeah, yeah, and also because these new emerging powers are not adequately represented. And so there's a whole challenge of adapting this institution to the new geopolitical reality. Democracy is also under challenge. Democracy was an embodiment of Western civilization. Is not not really... triumphing all over the world, but it is in fact more and more contested by other powers or other civilizations. The universality of Western values is more and more challenged by others.
You mentioned, back to this point about the post-World War II institutions, you had a telling phrase where you said the U.S. ambivalence toward these institutions in this latter period. Right. You refer to Clinton's benevolent opportunism and Bush's destructive contempt. So in different ways, both American leaders fail to provide the leadership which, in your view, involved adapting those institutions to the new centers of power and the new issues.
Yeah, I mean, America has always been very ambivalent about this. Basically, it invented the multilateral order after World War II. But at the same time, it always sort of kept a foot outside. I mean, it was good for the rest of the world, but it said always kept its freedom to act as a sovereign power. And so still today, there's a very strong sovereignist tradition in American foreign policy, which makes it actually closer to China, to Russia. And Europe is really an exception. There's sort of a European exceptionalism in trying to go beyond sovereignty, sharing sovereignty, go beyond nationalism, mm-hmm. etc. And so America has always been really ambivalent.
And you actually are suggesting later in the book that Europe is the European experiment may not be able to deal adequately right. with this resurgence of geopolitics.
Right.
Talk a little about that. Is it that the European institutions and the culture are too naive about the world as it is becoming?
Yes. I mean, there was a hope at some point, I mean, during this period of the 80s and the 90s, that the world was, in fact, that Europe was a sort of postmodern laboratory of world governance, that the world was, in fact, going to become like Europe, a world where states would share sovereignty and act together for the common good, et cetera, et cetera. But what we've witnessed is that instead of Europe spreading its model around, the rise of these new powers and the return of geopolitics has, in fact, isolated Europe. And Europe now has to really adapt itself to the new environment. And it has to think of itself as a power, at least an economic power, that has interests that needs to be defended. And it's really not the way the Europeans have been thinking of themselves. They had this sort of idyllic view of the world. They basically transposed their own experience of European unification to the rest of the world as if everything was homogeneous. But more and more we see that not only it's not the case, but we have a return to 19th century politics and geopolitics. And so what I'm saying is that the world we are entering into will be a dual world. There's the forces of of homogenization, of peace, of technology. I mean, the sort of Friedman flat world, which are there, obviously, fortunately, of interdependence. Mm-hmm. But you also have the conflicting forces of fragmentation, of power rivalries. And so it's really the crossing of these two dynamics that characterizes the world we are heading to.
You see America as better positioned than the Europeans talk a little about those reasons why, despite America's recent failures of adaptation, that we are positioned to adapt in the future.
Yeah, I think the strength of United States compared to Europe is one demography, because the United States will be the only industrialized power, which will have a demography that is closer to the new emerging powers of the South.
You know, which is a median age that's young.
Right, thanks to immigration and thanks to the fertility rate of immigrants in particular, whereas Europe will see a demographic decline and is now confronted with aging of its population. And that's a very important long-term trend. Another aspect is, of course, innovation. I mean, the U.S. is still the strongest country in R&D, innovation, productivity, and dynamism of, I wouldn't say the financial market, but it's true that despite the vagaries that caused the crisis today, I mean, the United States is a very dynamic economy. And so that's another. And another strength is, of course, the university. I mean, the U.S. is still the world's university, and there will be new competitors. I think China is investing billions of dollars in creating world-class universities, but for quite a while still, the U.S. has that advantage, has the English language, has the universal language. So there are a lot of key assets that the U.S. have, and also being a nation, being a continental nation, just like China or Brazil or India, whereas Europe is a continent, but it probably never will be a nation. So that's why I think that on the whole, the U.S. is the problem that the U.S. has is learning to share sovereignty, because it will be we're entering a world where there will no longer be a monopoly or even a duopoly with Europe. There will be the need to share power and to engage others, and so the U.S. has to learn that, because it hasn't been. Didn't have to do that in the past. And for that, Europe is better prepared, because that's really the European experience to share sovereignty.
You have a listing of the extent to which politics in the democracies, the West, has in recent years been failing. Weak support for parties and governments in power, division of the electorate, leading to very narrow margins to govern, weak international stature of leaders, triumph of popular opinion over political vision and courage, the rise of populism and extremism, marked provincialism of political class and national debates. It's a kind of a general indictment, but if you're right, and these ring true, these items ring true, what is the key to leadership in the West, assuming the responsibilities that you're very powerfully arguing they have to assume?
Right. Well, I'm a believer in I'm more a believer in representative democracy than in direct democracy, for instance. And that's something that's quite that's really American rather than European. There's a distrust of direct democracy and referenda and the like in the United States, and from that I'm very American, but generally there is a crisis of democracy in throughout the West, which also strengthened the adversaries of democracy around us. My sense is that we are in times of increasing complexity of everything, of increasing influence of, thanks to globalization, of outside events. I mean, you can see today the financial crisis, but there are many other examples where everything is tied together. And at the same time, you have this political impulse of participative democracy, grassroots democracy, populism, et cetera, et cetera. And my sense is that leadership is really a time where you take on responsibility, you lead, you make decision, then you try to convince the people of your vision, but you do not ask them for their opinion and you don't follow their opinion. And take the issue of national referenda in Europe. I think it's absolutely silly when you are 27 countries. It's already so difficult to come to agreement on a treaty. There's 27 parties. You have national parliamentary ratification. If you had a third layer of national referenda, which is totally hostage to domestic politics, it just doesn't make any sense. And so that's what I think. It's a times for leadership in the sense of having a vision and leading and not. But we are in a media democracy where politicians look at the opinion polls every day and tend to follow public opinion rather than lead.
Are you a realist in the sense that you think events will force, for example, the United States to see these new realities? And here we can bring in the financial crisis because clearly there aren't going to be the resources to do what we might have done before the financial crisis. And it's going to become very apparent that there is an interdependency that we've touted but not accepted as a reality for ourselves.
Yeah, I think that unfortunately, since better means, it is external events that are forcing, and it applies both United States and Europe. I mean, United States, September 11 was a real shock that also, showed everybody that something that happened way out in Central Asia and Afghanistan, or places that nobody had ever heard about, had an impact right in the center of American power. Same for the financial crisis. I mean, if you take Europe, Europe is not a federation. We don't have a federal budget. We don't have a treasury. But we had to cope with this emergency. And last weekend, we were able to coordinate action throughout Europe to try to provide a rescue package. And so it is external events that will eventually force further integration, and it's a pity that we need that, but certainly in Europe there's a sort of view that Europe constructs itself through in crisis and through crisis, and I think that we are seeing the same thing here.
Were you surprised that Europe led on this package, Europe being led by Britain in a way, because the Prime Minister came up with the solution first.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the U.S. had tried several things in the past few days, and it was clear. And I think there was a lot of commentators that said we need really to go straight to the root. We need to bring new capital to these banks. We need to restore the credit market. And so Gordon Brown came up with a solution for Britain, and then it was adopted by the others. I think Europe has been leading. Take also the Russia Georgia crisis of this summer. There was France has the presidency of the EU today for this semester, and Sarkozy went and went to Moscow and negotiated the ceasefire agreement and so on. And so I think Europe has been taking the lead in negotiation with Iran also. The U.S. has been kind of stuck in Iraq and Afghanistan. So Europe has tried to supply take some leadership, and I think that's a positive thing. What is problematic is that I don't think that we could have had the same result with, for instance, for the Georgia crisis, if we had a former Soviet satellite in the lead of the European Union, which means that we need a stable presidency. That's one of the items of the new treaty that we're trying to, the Lisbon Treaty. Mm-hmm. We need a stable presidency that doesn't change every 6 months, and because otherwise you will have ups and downs depending on the capacity of each country. So those are the things, and I think that this crisis will provide a strong argument in favor of a further institutional reform in Europe.
These two items you just mentioned go against what seems to be the argument in the book that Europe will be marginalized because of the failure of the EU experiment to understand the implications of enlargement?
No, I think when I'm talking about marginalization, it's more in the economy. I mean, there's a Europe really needs to move forward in the knowledge-based economy and in innovation, in productivity. Otherwise, it really risks being marginalized in an economy that will have two major poles, the United States on one hand and China and the rest of Asia. And so it's really more a sort of economic effort that needs to be, and that was the subject of this mission I did for the French government. It's not really, of course, at the same time, Europe also needs to assert itself in the world and have a real foreign policy and increase its defense budget, all those things. But we've sort of made progress in that, but I'm mainly thinking of the economy.
Looking ahead, the result of reading your book is there are a number of problems out there that are going to have to be addressed. The rise of China and its integration into the global system. This whole problem of the destabilizing factor of elements of Islam and so on. In addition, these newly emerging powers have a very different view of the kind of system they want, as you discussed. What is leadership from the West going to look like in addressing those problems, and where are the places where they will be addressed in the international arena?
Right. Well, first of all, I want to say that I do not view this as a negative evolution. It's something that we just need to be aware of. As I said, the rise of China and India, in sort of humanitarian terms, mean really the rise out of poverty of hundreds of millions of people. And it's also good to have more cultural diversity, etc. So, but I think the priority for the West is to, obviously, as it has done before, is to really engage those new players in the multilateral system to continue having a policy of openness, of engagement. Take climate change, for instance. We can't do anything on climate change without India and China. Some of the other geopolitical crises. We need Iran, North Korea. We need the support of China and Russia. For climate change, we need the support of the United States, of course, as well. But at the same time, we need also to remain vigilant because, again, historically, it's been very rare to see economic power without political power and military power. And again, we're in a world of with new non-Western forces, non-democratic forces. So we need to maintain at all times, in my view, and that's maybe coming back to the childhood influence, we need to maintain the strategic superiority of the West, of democracy, at all times. But provided that this is maintained, we need to do everything we can to, engage and create a new multilateral order. That's really the priority of the day. It's a new international institution. We need to engage the Arab Muslim world in economic globalization and democratic modernity. We need to fight these global hazards, proliferation, pandemia. We need to address. And the U.S. has to obviously restore its leadership role and its international credibility, its soft power to do that. That is absolutely an essential task of the next president.
Mm-hmm. One final question, and that is, what role does international law play in this? I mean, I know that you do corporate law, but is international law key to building rebuilding and rejuvenating the international institutions?
Yes, I mean, first, there's the first priority is really to have institutions that are both representative of the new balance of power and efficient, that can make decisions. We do have a body of international law that is, you know, obviously needs to be updated, but that is not, in my view, the priority, because we have that. We just need to make to be able to make decisions that are efficient and legitimate. But of course, yes, I mean, the goal is to arrive at a world that is governed by the rule of law and not by force, obviously. And we had that, and we had a lot of progress, for instance, in international criminal justice, for instance. That has been a real breakthrough in the past 20 years, the Criminal Court of Justice, etc. But at the same time, we must not be naive, because we are in a world of power and interest. And so Europe, for instance, can no longer simply, you know, plead in favor of peace, the rule of law, etc., in a world that functions differently. So we need to adapt to that, too. We need to be realistic as well.
Well, Loren, I want to thank you for coming on our program, and for writing this book and sharing your observations with us. And let me show the book again to our audience, The Shape of the World to Come, Charting the Geopolitics of a New Century. Thank you again for being here.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.